Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Big Experiment, a podcast that goes behind the scenes of science and business to discover the people and the stories that make new technology happen. My name's Mark Davison, and my day job is CEO of Grant Instruments. We make laboratory instruments and equipment. You can go to grantinstruments.com if you want to know more, but that's the last you're going to hear about it from me. Any views I express here are my own, not the company's. So this show is about other people, and it's about how they use their science and business skills to make the world a better place. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy this episode, don't forget to like, comment, subscribe, and share. Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of The Big Experiment. I'm joined today by Dr. Steve Harvey, co-founder and CEO of Camina Bio, based here in Cambridge, UK. So hi, Steve. Welcome. Nice to see you on this beautiful sunny day here in Cambridge.
Thanks for inviting me to the show, The Big Experiment. I like the name as well, by the way.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's designed to look at that interface between the lab and the company. You know, it's the biggest experiment you're ever going to run as a person, thinking the hypothesis being, can I make this work as a company? So I just wanted to dig into how founders make that work. And it's, I know from my own experience, and I'm sure you do, it's never smooth sailing, is it? So we'll dig into that in a minute. Maybe just to set the level for listeners, can you just describe what the company does, what the tech is in sort of non-specialist terms?
Yeah, so we make, Camina Biosense makes synthetic DNA. Specifically, we focus on making long and complex DNA sequences. And to unpack that a little bit, really at the kind of core of almost all forms of biotechnology research and development is the ability to read, write, and manipulate DNA. And the writing of manipulate DNA, that's where we have a leading technology. We can write long and complicated DNA sequences. And that's used for a really wide range of applications. Almost every corner of biotechnology is dependent upon some form of synthetic DNA. We work with a number of companies like pharmaceutical companies that have a requirement for synthetic DNA to make new medicines of a range of different flavors, if you like, as well as more industrial forms of biotechnology where they're developing enzymes to make new products. And so, yeah, so that's what we do. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that must have taken a bit of a boost. I mean, COVID was a strange catalytic time for biology, wasn't it? And a horrible time for society. But that whole mRNA, DNA sequence-focused medicines really came to the fore, didn't it? And I guess that must have given the whole field a bit of a boost.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, you probably experienced it as well, Mark, is that I guess a couple of things. One thing that happened was that the investments into biotechnology became quite distorted during that time because no one knew what was going to happen, right? And investors, for a period of time, shied away. As we went into lockdown, they shied away from any forms of investments into any company. Yeah. And then as we went, kind of started to go through the pandemic, it was a lot of people realized that actually biotechnology was one of the great areas to focus on investing. And, you know, the production of vaccines really did bring that type of technology really to the, you know, to every home in the world. We're talking about mRNA vaccines. I think it's really interesting now, though, because we're seeing a lot of companies trying to take that technology that they developed and adapt it for new applications. I've seen some really interesting publications using that mRNA type vaccine type technology for forms of cancer therapies. Yeah. I think it's going to be a really exciting area, future application of that technology. Really, really interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, isn't it, the way that's developing, and it's not going to be quick. It never is in drug development, but the pathways to proof of concept are quicker nowadays. When I started in drug development, I was isolating natural products from soil organisms in SmithKline Beecham back in the early 90s, and it could take you months and months to get an active compound, and then years to do some med chem to see if you could make it at scale, and then it would kill a rat and that would be the end of it.
The other thing as well is that the market of biotherapeutics used to be completely monoclonal antibodies, well, mainly monoclonal antibodies. And what we've seen over the last few years is an increasing number of DNA and RNA-based therapies coming to the market. It's amazing to see things like the CRISPR-Cas9 technology.
Yeah.
Again, completely different type of medicine that's now going into patients. And there's the mRNA vaccines, but also other forms of DNA-based therapies like gene therapies. Yeah, so it's a this is such a wide range of applications and tools that people can now use to make medicines or other forms of biotechnology as well. But I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're seeing this kind of explosion of different types of therapies that companies can make. So very exciting, yeah.
And what's the trajectory, do you think, on cost? I mean, those are great, but, you know, $250,000 or $500,000 per patient dose, you know, there's a lot of difficulty with that at the moment. And the same with stability. You know, if you've got to keep them at minus 80 and until 10 minutes before they're administered, you know, there's a lot of practicalities with those drugs that need to be ironed out as well, I guess.
I'm smirking because I had this conversation came up when I was at an event this week, which resulted in a very heated debate between a couple of CEOs, which they were obviously for the same problems. You know, some of these at the moment, these are medicines that are only, they have to go through further kind of clinical trials, a lot of these, but they at the moment are at a price point that is way above being rolled out to across the world. And so for these to really truly be successful medicines, they have to, these are problems that are going to have to be tackled. The other thing as well is that obviously there's a complication as well. I'm sounding like we're a pharmaceutical company. We're obviously not. We make tools for pharmaceutical companies, but you know, a lot of revenue that's been generated through this, through these medicines that are made have tended to be recurring revenue because people will take a pill, for example, for a long period of time. And now we have technologies that can actually cure patients through forms of gene therapy, for example. And so, I mean, there's lots of experts on this subject. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert, but it's really complicated to think about the pricing structure and how you can roll that out and how companies remain sustainable and profitable, but whilst also delivering in an effective way medicines to as many patients as possible. So,
yeah, completely. And I think we've lost that ability to do the sort of quality adjusted life years calculation, qualies as we used to call them, but that figuring out that, yeah, it costs $250,000, but it's a one-time shot and the person's cured. So
yeah,
per extra year of life, it's actually very cost effective.
Yeah.
You know, that's why antibiotics are difficult to develop, because they cure the thing. They don't leave you dependent on drugs for years on end.
Yeah.
So it's difficult, but again, I think those are the right questions to have. You know, if we've got the therapies, everything else follows in its wake, doesn't it? If we don't have the therapies, then we're nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's right, because, you know, ultimately a lot of these companies put a lot of money into expensive research. You have to be able to discover these new types of therapies, and they cost a huge amount of money to make medicines. So yeah, but yeah, super interesting. There's so many different types of DNA and RNA based applications in therapeutics, but just not just there, actually. Just there's, the thing that's really interesting for me is that last year I saw some really amazing applications of AI for types of engineering of enzymes. And I know that AI was kind of in every household, it was a discussion because of things like ChatGPT. And that's not what I'm actually referring to. Seen a number of companies that building databases and models that are allowing them to remove parts of discovery pipelines that were in a lab before and are now completely computational, or to actually take a process that's been to some degree in place for a while, but now discover new medicines or new enzymes, new proteins through forms of machine learning and AI. So that's another really exciting area of where DNA is being translated into, using AI is being translated into, again, further applications that previously we weren't able to access. So that's another pretty exciting area.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's definitely going to help, I think, with career development. I just want to come back to your early career and inspiration in a moment, but I think the more we can give people fulfilling early careers, not having to beat their head against a brick wall of failed experiments, then the more you retain bright minds to do the really interesting stuff, which is when you have got a lead and you can do something with it.
Yeah.
So I just want to come back to you. So you're a kid at school, and what lights the science fire for you? What sort of says, I want to go to university, I want to do a degree in science, I want to be a scientist?
So it's quite a long time ago.
Listen, that's nothing on me.
So I'll confess, when I was a student, I wasn't a great student. I used to love playing sports and things like that. I left school and I went to a sixth form college. And there were two things that happened. I guess what is quite a pivotal point in anyone's life when you're 16, 17. And actually, so there were no scientists in my family. So becoming a scientist was like a complete anomaly.
Like an astronaut.
Yeah. So there were two things that happened. So one is that, I guess maybe three. One is I took a biology as an A level. And I had a great teacher who explained to me what's the central dogma of molecular biology. And that's, you know, DNA gets turned into RNA, gets turned into proteins. And I thought, well, that's pretty straightforward. I get that. At the same time, the Human Genome Project was full steam. So this was, I went to university in 99. So this thing, 97, 98. And so that was a huge, you know, moonshot project that was happening across the world to sequence for the first time, to create a draft of the human genome. Another really pivotal point, which is probably has happened to a number of people that go into science, is that at the time, my mum had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and it was pretty bad. So I mean, she survived this incident, but ultimately, you know, about 12 years later, it did kill her. But she had a very aggressive breast cancer. And she had to have pretty major surgery, but then had a very chemotherapy called cisplatin.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's horrendous. So there's nothing like a moment of reflection of hanging out in an oncology ward where people are really unwell. And so I guess probably there was a little bit of a light bulb moment for me in some of those classes that I was doing, and also hearing in the news about the Human Genome Project. It was like, well, that seems so simple, because if you can sequence DNA in patients, you can work out the mutations. And then if you work out the mutations, you can understand the disease and you can make medicines and blah, blah, blah. Okay. And so with that enthusiasm, I went off to the University of Nottingham, where I studied a degree in human genetics. And when I was there, I was quite early on, I thought, you know, I actually really want to be a scientist. I just thought this seems like such a fun, cool job. And I decided then to go straight to do a PhD. I did a PhD in developmental biology. Developmental biology at the National Institute for Medical Research, which is now the Francis Crick Institute in King's Cross. And I became quite interested in understanding what genes do, really understanding the function of genes. And that was really the basis of basically becoming a scientist and you know, wearing a white coat, holding pipettes and safety goals and stuff. That it was, and it was great fun. I loved being a bench scientist. Yeah.
Yeah. It takes you back, doesn't it? Those days. I mean, I guess like me, you probably do a lot less. I do none of it, but you probably don't hold a pipette or a multi-well plate very often these days.
No, if I go into the lab, I'm given a visitor's coat.
Yeah. I'm usually kept at least a meter away from anything wet.
Because what did you study at, you know, because you went to university in Edinburgh, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. So I was a biochemist, and yeah, I loved it as well. You know, like it lit the spark. And at the time I took the decision to join Smith Kline Beecham. I thought, well, you know, they don't have any glass ceiling for non-PhDs. I'll join there and I'll grow up through the ranks. You know, it gives you 3 years longer because you start 3 years later, but you know, you've got a chance. And that worked fine until they closed our site in the UK. And then I sort of took that opportunity to go into commercial roles.
But so you're right. So you went straight into, essentially into biotechnology and pharmaceutical.
Yeah. And the pitch from them was, look, you can have a PhD. Great. You know, we'll start you 3 years later down the track. But if you don't have one, then we'll teach you the skills on the job. And, you know, true to their word, you could keep pace with PhDs who were, you know, ahead of you in that sense.
Yeah, but that's not the case in academia as well. Yeah. If you want to pursue a...
No, which kind of created a reverse lockout really afterwards, I subsequently realized, because you can't really go back and, you know, you can't say, well, I've got 3 or 4 years experience, therefore, you know, I'm the same as a PhD, because you're not, clearly.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons. But yeah, I decided, I think correctly with hindsight, that I was interested in science. I wasn't a particularly great routine lab bench scientist. You know, I used to get a little bit impatient with the repetitive experiment structure and constant failure. So I thought, well, let's channel that and do something with it in science, but not holding the Gilson, as it were.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's but everybody has a different path, don't they? Everybody, you know, ends up doing something along that track.
Yeah, but I think your case highlights a little bit of some degree of a misunderstanding in certain academic circles that you have to get a PhD before you can go on to maybe a career in industry. And that's actually not the case. I mean, people can go in with one degree, or maybe not even a degree, go with other forms of qualifications and begin career trajectory within biotechnology. Yeah.
Yeah. And then these days, especially, that there's a lot of, I would say, industrial style skills that are needed in startups, not just the academic wet lab skills, but actually, you know, quite a lot of applied technology type of skills, which do lend themselves.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. So your PhD's done and you joined the Sanger Institute. What was that bridge?
Well, actually, met my now wife in London, and we were deciding to kind of move out of London. And we kind of pinned in the map in Cambridge and thought, well, there are lots of jobs in Cambridge and might be a good place to start thinking about, I guess we were thinking about growing up. And I actually took a job at a place called the Girden Institute on Tennis Court Road in Cambridge, working for someone called Jim Smith, who went on then to be the director of National Institute for Medical Research. And it was a really interesting time because what I convinced Jim to let me do an RNA-seq experiment. So yeah, it was basically a new form of DNA sequencing had come to market. It was a next generation sequencing. And I convinced him that we could use this to understand what genes were doing in early frog embryos. And we went off and did an experiment. And I think we must have been probably the first people that were doing this on Tennis Court Road. And we got this file back that had 30 million sequencing reads. And I just thought it's incredible. This is like we've just got this huge amount of data that seems so accessible. It's so easy to do. And then the next thing I realized was that I couldn't even open the file, and I didn't know. I'd never written a line of code in my life. And so, you know, in order to be, you know, what people refer to as a bioinformatician, to be a good bioinformatician, you need to know how to write code, or at a bare minimum nowadays, you need to know enough code to talk to a bioinformatician. And I just thought it's kind of like so much data in front of us, but I actually can't access it. And I need to learn how to be able to use this type of next generation sequencing technology. And I was very lucky that someone I'd met at the National Institute for Medical Research was a faculty member at Sanger Institute, the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in Hingston, which was a big part of the human genome sequencing project. And I convinced him to let me go and hang out with him in his lab and really begin to start using forms of this next generation DNA sequencing technology. And yeah, it was a super cool time because everything just changed our ability to sequence DNA. And so when I went to university in 99, 2000, it cost around about $100 million to sequence one human genome. And I don't know the exact cost today, but it's got to be, you know, it's probably below $500. It's a huge transformation, which has completely changed how you sequence DNA. So that's the reading of DNA.
A lot of it driven out of Cambridge, of course, with the Solexa and then Illumina thing.
Yeah, so Solexa sequencing, came from inventions in chemistry department.
Yeah.
You know, scratched out on the Panton Arms around the corner.
Yeah.
As the story goes. And then Solexa sequencing was actually based here. I'm pointing that way. You know, it's on a patch of grass out here. The buildings are gone now. But then that was acquired by Illumina, and that really led to Illumina being really kind of the world's number one DNA sequencing technology. Really amazing story. Transformed the whole industry.
Yeah.
So we went, there was actually two transformations we had at the time when I was still working as a bench scientist. So our ability to read DNA changed overnight. We used to say things like, you know, don't think, just sequence, right?
Mm-hmm.
We just would sequence and sequence and sequence.
That was unheard of even 5 years, 10 years before.
Oh yeah. It's just too expensive. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then our ability to manipulate DNA, really manipulating what people would probably think of now as gene editing, that changed a huge amount as well. So there were a couple of technologies that were around. There was one, zinc finger nucleases. So these are ways that you can target very specific sequences in the genome and make mutations that deliberately make mutations to remove the function of that gene. And there's a number of reasons why you would do that. There was another technology called TALENs, and it got slightly better. It's really hard, slightly better. And then there was the invention of CRISPR-Cas9. And then suddenly just overnight, everything changed there. So on that value chain of reading, writing, and manipulating DNA, we saw that the ability to read DNA and to manipulate DNA changed a huge amount. But the technology to write DNA, to make synthetic DNA, did not change. And that was a technology that was really became an industry standard within the 1980s and hadn't changed really up to that point. And there were a couple of things that we saw as well. We saw more and more of a problem with synthetic DNA because of the things that were changing around it. So we did an experiment once where, I mean, we were being really tight, right? So the kits used to be really expensive. We could pretty much work out what was in the kits. And so we decided to try and make our own homebrew kits. We'd buy the enzymes from another company and then the short bits of DNA that you need to make, the short bits of DNA called oligonucleotides. And we bought them from another provider, made these kits. They didn't really work that well, but we went off and did some sequencing. And then it took us months and months and months to unpack the results.
Yeah.
And what we found was that the DNA that we'd bought in was very error prone, And the other thing that happened as well, and we had no evidence of this, but it appeared that the provider was trying to save money by reusing types of columns that you use to make the DNA. So it was contaminated.
Right.
So I think that was probably one of the first pieces of evidence that made us think, well, actually, this technology is really limiting. The other thing that we realized as well was that when we started to think about longer and longer pieces of DNA, so when you think about a gene, so the average coding sequence of a gene is over 1,000 base pairs, so it's 1,000 A, T, C's and G's.
Yeah.
So the longer you go, the more difficult it is to make DNA sequences. And we found that most of the genes that we wanted to buy from a provider, they couldn't make them. And so those were the two kind of things that made us to start thinking about new DNA synthesis, it's DNA writing technologies. And that was the basis of us, you know, going to start the company really.
That's the scientific seed. What's the personal and business seed? I mean, your co-founder, Derek Stempel, you know, very well-known biologist yourself, you know, do you get together in a coffee room and you think, we could do this commercially, or is it more gradual and evolving than that?
Oh, yes. No, it was never. Well, so maybe to think that a lot of companies that go and you start a company, a lot of the time, the first idea is not the thing that you end up with.
Definitely.
I think that's always an important thing when you're, for investors, when they're, you know, looking at an early stage investment in a company, is like, you know, if they don't solve this problem, will they solve something else? I think that's an important trait that you need to consider.
And that's no bad thing, actually, is it? Having that ability to pivot is not something to be ashamed of. It's actually just life.
No. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When we quit our jobs and we went out, we wanted a new life, quite frankly. We were looking for a new challenge. And so we quit and we went out to start the company. And the first idea actually was we were going to use DNA to store digital information. And so, you know, when you store a photo or, you know, this clip that we're recording now, it's ones and zeros. So the idea is that you can store that essentially in A, T, C, and G, and you can store that information for a long period of time. And it works. It does actually. There's quite a lot of evidence that this approach works, and you can. But then, so we thought we could create a company that would do that. But we realized two things early on. One is that we realized that the cost of making DNA was just way too expensive for this to ever be a product. And I can't quite remember, but I think we thought, well, we would have to drop the costs by about a millionfold. That's a big challenge.
That's a long runway.
That's a long runway. And then I guess the more kind of fundamental problem was that it would be a product that you would sell to people to store information long term. And so you're really thinking about providing a product to people, perhaps like banks or medical records. And these are people that are the laggards. You know, they are not going to adopt a new technology for storing information for a long period of time to only work out, you know, decades later that this is actually a huge problem. And so that was the first idea, and we abandoned that. But of course, in amongst that, that was very early on. But we'd been thinking for a long period of time about the core technology of how you make DNA, basically.
What was your inventive step? I mean, that you've got a G-synth technology, you know, without revealing the intricacies of that. And what was that step that you thought, aha, here's a thing that's completely different?
Yeah. So when we started, had an idea that there's another problem that we've been trying to solve, and we don't talk very openly about this, but existing technology from that's been around since the 1980s produces a lot of waste, a lot of solvent-based waste. And so for every kilogram of DNA you make with that technology, you generate over 10 tons of waste. And it's very, very flammable waste that in some way has to be burnt off. Okay. And so what we wanted to do is to, we have been working on this and we will continue to work on this, to essentially remove the generation of waste through making synthetic DNA. And we wanted to shift away from, that was inorganic chemistry, to a more natural enzymatic way of making DNA. And so in cells, the way that DNA is copied is through enzymes called DNA polymerases. And there's many, many different types of these enzymes that you can find in nature. And we'd had an idea where we found one that we thought, well, we could, if we made a specific type of those basic building blocks of DNA and combined it with this enzyme, that we could use it to write DNA sequences. It's an enzyme called TDT. And so when we started the business, we thought, well, okay, that's a good idea. We'll raise some money. We'll develop the intellectual property. When we have the intellectual property, then that's a value inflection point for the business, and we can go off and, you know, then start to raise money that will bring the product to market. And so we kept, so in that early phase, the idea was just develop intellectual property, no customers to start off with. So we did that. And so we went off and started to develop some intellectual, and so filed the patent. And then there were two things that happened after that. One is that we found out that about five other companies, startups, had filed almost the same piece of intellectual property, slight twists of, you know, chemistry combinations of enzymes, but almost exactly the same. And the more fundamental problem was that we could just never get it to work. We had evidence that we could add, you know, one base of DNA, but the problem was it was really inefficient. And so actually we believe that that approach is more error prone than the existing technology. And so this was kind of a little bit of a moment of self-reflection for us in the business.
I imagine.
We abandoned the piece of intellectual property. And that was actually pretty painful, because our initial idea we thought was going to be, you know, a golden ticket of success was not. But
had you spun out by this time, or were you still in the lab?
Yeah, no, we'd gone. We'd quit our jobs.
Yeah.
We quit our jobs. And I mean, this is another thing with starting companies. Founders of companies generally aren't very good at assessing risk. So we quit our jobs. And actually, we initially wanted to go to start the company at another research institute. And they said, oh, we'll love to welcome you, start the company here. But we have 9 companies in the waiting list because there's a demand for lab space. And we said, well, that's great, but we've already quit our jobs. So we had to find another lab. I think probably the last lab in town was the one that we found here at Chesterford Research Park. And so when we were doing these experiments, we were doing them all here. We started. And the other thing as well is that when you get a really early stage company, you're really cash restricted.
Absolutely.
You have to be really kind of careful about how you're spending money. And if that invention didn't work, that's pretty tough, because you've got to do something else before your cash runs out.
And what was the cash fund at that point? Was it savings? Anybody you can tap up for a few quid, or did you get some early seed funding?
Well, I did the painful thing of I didn't pay myself to start off with,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
which was not comfortable, I can tell you. So Derek, who I started the company with, had a company before that had been successful. And so we were lucky that he was able to provide essentially the first check for the company. I think it was a check for probably £50,000, which is an astronomical amount of money. But the reality is that turns the lights on.
It's rent for a few months.
It's rent. It's a deposit, and it's rent, and, you know, no furniture, you know, nothing. And then we brought in people in essentially a seed. We built up a seed round of investment over a period of time through just basically through our network. So we built up enough that allowed us to run these, get in the lab up and running largely with secondhand equipment, yep. You know, do some basic experiments, some legals around filing intellectual property, for example, before we would have to go out and raise more money.
But so this was entirely private sector then? There was no sort of legacy from the Sanger or Hingston or anybody else giving you any IP support? This is all your bag.
We went out. We had nothing. So very, very risky. Two young kids. I told my wife that it'll be fine.
As we do.
Two young kids and a mortgage. And it was a little bit do or die, quite frankly. I had a lot of skin in the game.
Yeah. But I think that forges you as a person, doesn't it? I mean, I always think that spin out is a bit of a glib term, isn't it? It's like, you know, Superman or Wonder Woman. You know, you a few revolutions and you come out with a costume on and off you go to superpowers. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I thought more about this because it was a very risky thing to do. And in hindsight, you know, it was a good thing to do. Should I have been taking more risk earlier on in my career? Should I have made this kind of jump into the abyss before? I think, I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's quite an interesting question. Yeah.
Yeah. There is no perfect time. Sometimes the science finds you, doesn't it? It's not like you evolve to a point that you can see coming. It's the opportunity presents.
Yeah. But good to go back to your original question. So in the ashes of this technology that we threw away, it forces us to reflect upon what we actually really did need to do. And there was never really one kind of light bulb moment. Actually, I don't know the final number at the moment, but it's probably about 11 pieces of different intellectual property, which are a range of different applications, which are used now in we call it, it's the kind of an umbrella term, G-Synth. And that's everything from computational design to enzymes, highly pure reagents, but they all come together, which means that the way that we make DNA is very accurate and we can make genes that other companies can't make. So about 300 base pairs, we're about 90% accurate, whereas the old technology is about 25 to 30% accurate. So we made quite a big step. So that through the ashes, we made that step. And that was the basis of kind of going forward for then commercializing that core technology to where it is today. Yeah.
And that's a huge commercial benefit to the user, isn't it? I mean, that's quadrupling and more the efficiency that they were getting before. I mean, that's fairly easy to do a cost benefit analysis, I imagine, in your sales pitch.
Yeah, it's also, I guess, by sort of as you extend it, we always wanted to get a point where we were providing very long pieces of DNA, gene length at least, pieces of DNA. We have companies that come to us and say, we think this is a valuable medicine, but no one can make it. And they will relate that to patient outcomes. So, well, we've tried for 8 months. In a pharmaceutical context, they do think about patient outcomes in that way. So it's really where the way we see ourselves in the world is really kind of like an architect of research engines. So really we want to be enabling companies. So we make DNA, and you know, on the face of it, that's kind of boring, right? But that kind of dogged pursuit of continuing to improve it is enabling other people. So it's not really the end goal for us. The end goal for us is actually that enablement in other companies where they can do things that they weren't able to do before.
Yeah. And I think that whole tool space is underappreciated, isn't it? The helping other people to do the Nobel Prize stuff is just as important as the actual light bulb experiment that gets the headlines, because if you weren't there, they couldn't do that.
Yeah, more tools, more fire. Yeah,
absolutely.
You can really do different things. Yeah, and so we don't know what some of those applications will be in the future. But yeah, it's pretty exciting.
And I think having what the investors call a wide moat is useful, isn't it? Having a big defense mechanism, enough IP that you can pivot a little bit, you can duck and dive, you can have different customer bases when one dries up. I think that's really handy.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's a very, for obviously, so not all companies need to be IP rich, but if you're developing a new technology, you need to really think about how you're protecting it from a strong IP base. We've always taken a position of creating what people refer to as a very kind of composition of matter intellectual property. So that's like, you know, that's this, how do you create as much scorched earth around your core technology through every patent and a series of patents around the technology that can protect your business. Yeah,
absolutely. So I want to come on to another theme, which you're very active on LinkedIn, particularly around people and the process, the people processes around small companies. So you both sat there, I'm picturing, on beanbags with a kettle on the floor and a rudimentary lab. How do you attract the first people to join you in that leaky boat traversing the sea of science?
Yeah, you know what? There were some pretty painful points, actually. But I think once you start attracting people, it is a little bit of a validation point, right? Because people are actually making a conscious decision to come and join, you know, your mission.
Yeah.
I guess I was relatively well known within academic circles in Cambridge. And I knew a few people on Tennis Court Road who had labs or, professors and things up, and there's quite a few labs, University of Cambridge labs on Tennis Court Road. And so I went knocking on doors and started telling people what we were doing. And then anyone who was kind of, I mean, to start off with, we were only looking for like one or one or two scientists to help out. And I remember talking to someone and they kind of laughed in my face.
Which is always fun.
Yeah, I really like you, Steve. Why would I quit my job and join you? This seems crazy. Yeah, that was pretty painful, actually. And then through that network, we ultimately attracted one or two people to join a business. And we kept the company quite small for a long period of time before things really started to take off. And then we've grown. Last year, we grew the company quite rapidly.
How do you keep, you've got a small team, how do you keep people happy? And in some ways, it's easier in a small team. The dynamics are pretty more linear, aren't they, than it is when as the team grows. But what's the difference you've seen as the company's evolved between that initial everyone in it together, working long hours, you know, taking one for the team, and then you evolve to a stage where some people, they're not just there for the salary, but, you know, there is more of a job type of approach to some of the employees that you're going to get later on.
And risk profiles change as well.
Yeah.
You end up needing to, you have to recruit people a little bit less tolerant of risks as well. So yeah, I mean, we kept it, you know, roughly around about four or five people for a number of years. And then we grew the company from five to, we're in the low 20s now. We'll go to about 20, 28 this year. But that as a proportion is actually quite a lot of growth.
Absolutely. Five or six times growth. That's,
yeah, it's actually a huge amount of change for everyone in that mix, because you have people that have been in the business for a while and then suddenly there's like more and more people coming. We had one guy went on holiday and three people turned up when he was on holiday. But then the people coming in, it's a huge amount of change as well, because they're maybe finding a new place to live. They may even be moving from like potentially one country to another. It's a huge amount of change. And it takes quite a lot of patience for those people to kind of start knitting together and working together.
And how did you engender that? I mean, I know you've got a very proactive approach to company culture, but what specifically were you doing to try and knit those disparate individuals into a team?
Yeah, so I've leaned in very heavily to principles-based approach for running the company. And that's based on an approach that was developed, at least it's very well known, is Ray Dalio, who's a hedge fund manager. And simply what we do is we write, if we see a problem, we write it down, we try to articulate how we solve that problem. And then we have that as a reference for how we can continue to improve the company. The other thing we do is we're very proactive at getting team members to contribute to that through a number of mechanisms that we have. And the company's always faced with problems, you know. You just have to hope they're always good problems.
Yeah.
And so we're always looking for ways to improve our principles. And so that's really, it's an operating framework of how we behave. And we've put a lot of effort into that. That's very much a whole team contribution to our operating framework. And, you know, it's probably sound quite nerdy, but we're now on, you know, the document is now 39 pages long. It started off as a one pager and we've added to it. We keep adding to it. We kind of roughly do about four versions of it every year, where we're tweaking things, we're adding new things, and everyone's contributing to that process. And so we're probably on about version 38 of our company principles. And so that's been very good for articulating how we value people, how we find people, how we value people, how we think, to more kind of like things like how we run meetings, yeah, those types of things. And so having that in place is quite a good way for integrating people, but it still takes a while to get them to think to this way of like running a company. But I think that is I've argued that's probably our most valuable piece of intellectual property. It's kind of really at the heart of the business and how we behave. Yeah.
Yeah. And culture is difficult, isn't it? I mean, that old quote by Peter Drucker about culture eats strategy for breakfast. You know, it's difficult to make culture. It doesn't just happen. You have to really, really work hard at it. And even then it sometimes doesn't work easily.
Yeah. And then, the other thing as well is that the people really define the culture. And as you grow rapidly, you have new people that have new opinions, and you know they could be from very different cultures, you know, even from different countries, and they will shape the company's culture. And so you need them contributing to this operating framework that we have. Yeah, But culture is not, it's not a static thing. It's never static.
No, absolutely. You have to tend to it all the time.
You have to tend to it all the time. I used to think, you know, because you'd look at companies' websites and you go, well, they've got these values. That's it. That's like one, it's actually just one snapshot. But in my mind, I thought, well, that's that. But it's completely dynamic. You have to, it's like a crop. You have to keep watering it, you know, don't shout it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing which evolves tremendously is in that journey is your own leadership, right? I mean, you start off as a team of two and you end up managing, you know, 20, 30 people and, you know, eventually 200 or 300 people probably, and you may not even know all their names after another while. How has that been for you, that evolution of your role from the founder scientist to the manager of departments?
Yeah. So I've had to fire myself from many roles within the company. Yeah. So when we started, I was in the lab, I was helping out with experiments. And, you know, you have cash problems in an early stage company. So we would do everything, you know, someone's got to sweep the floors, right? And then, you know, ultimately I've kind of fired myself from these roles as we've gone along and we've added people that can run some functions within the business. We're at kind of a pivotal point now where we're scaling the business. We're not inventing technology. We're always looking to invent technologies, but we've kind of crossed into that point where we're generating revenue. And so we have to scale the business and I have to scale with it. And so I have, you know, 1,000 things and I'm actually reducing them to actually just two or three things now. My role is actually not really to work as much in the business, as to work more on the business and more strategic elements and interacting with people. And so the challenge there is, and this is a really common problem, as you grow and the team gets bigger, communication changes. And you have to pick your kind of points of leverage. You kind of can't have as many one-on-ones as you used to. Yeah. It's not sustainable to have one-on-ones with every team member. You have to pick points of leverage where you can interact on some of those kind of core cultural elements with groups or, you know, or potentially with the whole company as well. So it's changed quite a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, I imagine. Well, we're nearly out of time, but I just wanted to ask you what's next for Kamina Bio. Clearly you're on an expansion curve. Is US expansion on the cards? Is there a particular area that you're looking to target?
Due to the companies that we work with, actually a lot of them are big multinational companies. And so actually we are pretty proactive in America already. These are companies that tend to have places all over the world that we're interacting with. Last year was a rapid year of growing the team, growing forms of automation in our labs, moving away from scientists holding pets to lots of robotics in the lab, and quite a strong revenue base that we're now at a point where we're scaling a lot of those operations, whereby we're increasing our capacity to make DNA by, you know, just numbers of base pairs of DNA, but also the speed and accuracy is continuing to go up. So we have a couple of probably big technical milestones that we'll make announcements this year as well around
Great.
Our ability to make DNA very, very, very quickly, substantially quicker than competition, which again is an advantage to some of our customers, which are really in research roles where they're trying to speed up what they're doing. So yeah, we're scaling. So we're expecting a lot of growth ahead of us. We're probably going to be expanding our lab base as well to increase our ability to make some of the kind of core reagents that some of our customers are using. So
yeah,
there's a lot ahead of us actually.
Yeah, it's a busy year coming up and I look forward to hearing more about it in the future as well. Well, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure, Steve. I could talk for hours on this subject and I'm sure we will again sometime. But in the meantime, thanks very much for your time. And to all listeners, thanks for tuning in and thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time. Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share if you did. And we'll see you next time.